Hello and welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download hundreds of previous Inside Education podcasts at seandelaney.com. This week I'm pleased to bring you more from my interview with Professor Ciarán Sugrue from University College Dublin. I spoke to him earlier this year in advance of his presentation to the Education Conference of the Association of Secondary Teachers in Ireland, the ASTI. Ciarán Sugrue has been Professor of Education at the School of Education in UCD since 2011. Prior to that, he worked at the Faculty of Education at the University of Cambridge. He has worked in the Irish education system in a variety of capacities, including teacher, schools inspector, teacher educator and researcher. Many primary teachers will remember him from his time in St Patrick's College from Condra, now Dublin City University. His research interests are wide-ranging and include school leadership and educational change, continuing professional development, and teacher professionalism. In this part of the interview, I referred to the introduction to his book, Complexities of Teaching, Child-Centred Perspectives, where he writes that he wants to understand, recover, and reinvent child-centred teaching. I asked Ciarán Sugrue what he understands as child-centred teaching.
First and foremost, what I was doing there, and in a way we've done the same thing with the 1999 curriculum, is that whatever number of years down the road, we said, that's it, it's done, it's implemented, you know. Well, that's nonsense in the sense that education is always evolving because the wider context in which education happens, and whether that's the different versions that we now have of family and what that looks like, of parenting, of social media, you know, and the list goes on and on, technology being the other obvious one. Clearly that has implications for children, childhood, pedagogy, and so on. So the notion that we can answer any of these questions once and for all just doesn't stand up. I'll give you an example that hopefully will kind of ring true for a lot of people. When I started teaching, I think the first class I had 48 or 51 pupils in it. Well, like, that sounds ridiculous by the standards of today. And then, as you know, a number of years ago, we said, especially in DESH schools, but not confined to DESH schools, we would only have 20 kids in a junior infant class. Of course, the working assumption is that reduced class size will lead to a better education. I sort of say, where's the evidence for that? Why would reducing the class size improve the education? And in fact, I remember around that time visiting junior infant classrooms. And what became hugely apparent to me is, so now, you know, we'd moved away from slates and chalk, and we now had massively increased the resources available, from Lego to you name it, right? Cuisinaire rods, all kinds of fancy stuff, and reduced class size as well. So now you would have thought, oh sure, junior infant teaching is now a dawdle. But what we forgot to factor into that is parenting had also changed in the meantime. Family size had changed in the meantime. So in the two children household, a child can get instant attention from an adult. So they come into school, and instead of sitting there with your mouth shut and doing what you're told, as happened in the past, now the kid is forever in your face and demanding attention and doesn't think twice about getting up and wandering around to access whatever the goodies are at the back of the room. And reducing class size actually facilitates that. You can move around the room if there are 20 kids in there. If there are 40 or 45, you can't. And so it has to become regimented. For all of those reasons, the dynamics of teaching and learning keep on changing. And we have to keep working at figuring out what's in the best interest of the child. I don't know how many of your listeners are fluent as Gaelge, but I could try this one and I can translate if necessary. A man I taught with for many years who had taught down in Navan at an earlier stage in his career. And if you can imagine, you know, drill and practice, a Christian brother teaching a sixth class and teaching the Thistle Ginnaduk, you know. So every morning there was 20 minutes spent at the Braher would say, Borna, and everybody would say, Na Broige, and, you know, it went on in that vein. So after he had put them all through their paces, if you like, he would then sort of top it off by saying, Is Kumalumsa Toge no Foge ni Lienskrudu Legenovagumsa. Now, I'd probably better translate that for you, but as Kumalumsa, it doesn't matter to me, take it or leave it, I don't have any examination to do. And I've used that sort of anecdote, if you like, over the years to make a point about education. What teachers tended to do, but in the context of child-centered pedagogy and active learning and putting kids at whatever age at the center of the learning. If you go back to the anecdote, what it said was, teaching is my job, learning is your job. So as soon as I've done the teaching bit, that's me in the clear. Whether you know it or not now, that's your problem, right? Well, we no longer subscribe to that kind of, you know, that there's much more of a symbiotic relationship between teaching and learning, which is why we've come up with other nice little kind of cliches about being the, not the sage on the stage, but the, what's the rest of it?
The guide on the side.
The guide on the side, exactly, yeah. These are cliches, but they're intended nevertheless to convey something important about the dynamics of the teaching-learning process.
And if you walked into a classroom in 2018, what would you have to see that you could come out and say, there's child-centred teaching going on in that room?
An overused word, of course, but I'd want to see engaged learners. Now, they could be engaged in various things. They would be likely doing, they would be likely discussing, they could be working on their own, they could be reading, they could be interacting with the teacher. And I think we've all recognized that learning is fundamentally a social process. That doesn't mean, so if it's all active learning, does that mean there's no quiet time, there's no solitude, there's no place for me to do my own thinking and to think my own thoughts?
Your 2015 book, Ciarán, is titled Unmasking School Leadership, A Longitudinal Life History of School Leaders. What is that book about?
It's about primary principalship, essentially. The backstory, if you like, is that an earlier book that I edited, which was Passionate Principalship, and it involved some contribution from Norway, Denmark and England. And at the time, this began around, I think the book was published in 2004 or 2005, but the data were generated around 99, 2000, 2001. And while I was busy trying to edit the book, the Norwegian in the game and the Dane in the game published national books out of the data that they had collected. So for me, there was always that sense of it was kind of unfinished business. So in the 2000 period, I ended up doing a series of three interviews with 12 primary principals in three different kind of categories. Neophyte, experienced and veteran were the, you know, now the cutoff was if you'd been in the job for 3 years, you were still kind of a novice or a neophyte. And then, you know, from there to, I can't remember exactly now, maybe 15 years, you were experienced. And then there were the veterans after that. And so, you know, that was 36 interviews over a period of time. And so the longitudinal bit, when I came back to this kind of the guts of 10 years later, I said, okay, how do I make this more contemporary, if you like? So I went back and I interviewed all of the original people, but I added another cohort of new principals, if you like. So now we were up to 16 and interviewed all the new cohort twice, as well as going back and interviewing. So I ended up with something like 60 interview transcripts by the time. So I now had to sort all of this out, so to speak. And I think from a, and it's interesting how rapidly the ground shifts now. So even since I finished that, which is only a three, four years ago, say, the extent to which the pace of change and what is now expected of the principal has, in a sense, been ratcheted up again. But what really was key for me is that you can talk all you like about different conceptions of leadership and whether it's distributed or whether it's transformational or instructional, and as you know, the list goes on and on. In the Irish system, where teachers are employed by individual boards of management, in what is already a very small system, there's a serious problem with mobility. I used to joke with students at one time that now that we have legislated for divorce, can we not have some kind of legislation that if I'm headbutting, you know, my principal regularly, can we not regulate that somehow so that one or other of us has to go? All of this is adding up to saying, because there's too little mobility in the system, we privilege good relations. I can't afford to call out Sean Delaney today because I have to work with him tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So we don't have what I call those more robust professional conversations as a consequence. And in fact, in the final chapter of the book, I, you know, with apologies to Vygotsky, I coined the notion of the zone of professional distance as opposed to the zone of professional or proximal development. And it's how do we create enough space and opportunity within the school as a community where the personal and the professional get addressed, as opposed to privileging the personal in terms of good relations. And, you know, when I've talked about that with various groups, at least they recognize that is a problem. I think culturally there's also the issue as well that we like to be liked. So calling a spade when it counts. In other words, there's an issue here also about moral compass, frankly, and about the courage of our professional convictions so that we do take a stand. And, you know, I think that's a serious issue. We could blame the convent, the brothers and whoever else in the past. It is our turn now. It is our responsibility. What are we actually doing about that?
And is that what you mean by unmasking school leadership?
Well, unmasking was, yeah, as the kind of, after you take off the mask, what really lies behind the day-to-day reality of being the principal, and arguably how that has evolved over time, you know.
One area of interest for you is continuing professional development for teachers. And I suppose, well, first of all, how do you view the changes to professional development provision for teachers that have taken place over the last two decades?
Well, I think it has probably improved in the sense that it's more organised and PDST has become a force in the land, so to speak. But there's still the issue. I'm not saying we should follow what goes on in the UK, but at least in the UK, a school has a budget for CPD. So you can draw on that selectively and you can, as they do, review what my professional needs are and make provision either within the school or beyond the confines of the school or bring in additional expertise. Now, some of that's happening, but it never ceases to amaze me that in a small system, how schools can vary so much. You know, some schools are, as you know, up there, they're with it, they're doing all of the kind of things that we might legitimately and reasonably expect of them. And then there are schools that are, you know, that old Dean Fink, Andy Hargreaves chapter, this would be a good school if this was 1965, you know. So I'm always staggered by that variation of how did it happen that time seems to have passed this school by. And of course, it does come back to the principalship and increasingly the board of management, where it's engaged and active and so on. And we've seen some evidence of that, but it's still too uneven. Now, as you know, Cusson, I've been critical of the title because where I come from, a Cusson is a rather narrow, winding sort of, you know, that might or might not is for sheep rather than for professionals. I would have thought that something like Tashtal or Thrus or something like that would have more possibilities in terms of, if you want to use metaphors, be careful what you wish for, as they say. The elephant in the room now seems to be in terms of re-registration with the teaching council. We're not there yet, but as we all know, it's coming down the tracks, and what my professional portfolio is going to look like, and how little or how much will I have to show evidence on an annual basis that's in it, and will that become compulsory? These are questions that arguably we're skillfully avoiding at the moment. But then if there's some truth in the assertion I'm making that what's the professional responsibility here? Avoidance is not the exercise of professional responsibility, would be my view. So we need to face up to the responsibilities and take them on and at least have a discussion about them. That's in the interests of the health of the profession in the first instance. But there is, in addition, in my view, the responsibility of individual and collective responsibility of, you know, the teacher as public intellectual, that teachers have a responsibility to bring issues of educational import into the public domain. And we have a very poor record in doing that, arguably.
One of the challenges for teachers in terms of continuing professional development is that it's difficult to know that you don't know something. What can be done to help teachers see when engaging in some form of professional development could help or enhance their practice?
I think, and I've heard this conversation recently. We had our Masters in Leadership students on campus here a couple of Saturdays ago doing what were really wonderful group presentations, some of them on homework, some of them on ICT and its complications and so on. But what was really most encouraging was here were groups of teachers working collaboratively outside of their own school, admittedly, but working collaboratively and arguably learning to collaborate, because we were in a way making this a requirement as part of the program. So there's no point in saying teachers need to collaborate if we don't encourage and support it. And so it has that benefit in the first instance. The other benefit, which in my view is hugely timely and part of the purpose, was they had to generate evidence around the homework, the ICT or whatever, which they did from a combination of reviewing relevant literature, but also in their own schools, generating data, which they then had to analyze, compare, and also come up with some kind of recommendations in the process. That's now what's being required by school self-evaluation. What was really encouraging, and I know I'm repeating myself here, was they demonstrated in spades a capacity to do that and to take up that responsibility. We don't hear about that in the media. So the quieter voices in the profession are busy renewing themselves and the profession in the process, while the megaphone diplomacy is going on in the media and at the national level that often is a very poor reflection of the profession as a whole.
But is the kind of initiative you're talking about, is that happening on a fairly small scale level compared to the profession as a whole?
Well, what's behind your question is it's not happening enough, I suppose.
Well, it's a question.
It is, but there's always something behind the question, Sean. Come on. In the ideal world, you know, and my preference is to live in the real world rather than the ideal world. The ideal world, which is kind of the assumption behind the question, is that shouldn't we all be doing this and wouldn't it all be wonderful if we were? It would, but that's not the real world. So the more people who do this, the better. The better for them, the better for their school communities, and more importantly, the better for the learners and their parents and the community. But what we don't do sufficiently is join the dots. Whether it's I'm with the basketball team or I'm sitting in a room with some of my colleagues planning the school tour or whatever it happens to be, or some aspect of the curriculum, that this is fundamentally about maximising opportunity for learners and also in the process making Ireland a better place to live, that we have a civic spirit and civic imagination and engage citizens. That picture has been lost. And if you look at the DES strategic plan, what do they want? They want us to be the best education system in Europe by 2026. Why not say with that we will be not the best small country in the world to do business in, but a place that is humane, is supportive, is culturally vibrant, is economically vibrant, and it's the place that people want to be when they talk about children and childhood and civic engagement.
You spent 10 years from 1998 to 2008 as editor of Irish Educational Studies. What did that work involve?
There were a number of things. No disrespect to my predecessors, but even though it called itself a journal, it was really a conference proceedings. So the challenge to me was to make it a real journal, if you like, and I've already said no disrespect to those who went before me. But because it was so onerous, with variation now, people did the job for 2 years, sometimes more, but by and large, they were happy to pass on the mantle to somebody else. As you pointed out, I stuck it out for 10 years. But during that time, we did make it a journal rather than a conference proceedings. And of course, the transition wasn't just then if you presented a paper at the conference, the paper had to be peer reviewed and so on. Now, there were elements of that going on, you know, prior to that, but not to the same extent. So partly through contacts with Taylor and Francis and so on, they initially refused, actually, and then came back sometime afterwards to say, you know, we're interested in this. And so that became a major issue that it was now being published by an international publisher. And that put Irish Educational Studies on a kind of a different plane. And I think it's reasonable to say there's now more international contributions to it, which has pluses and minuses to it from an Irish Education Studies point of view. And of course, you know, as all of the performativity thing got ratcheted up, being accepted into the index, you know, and so you were now getting more bang for your buck. That came towards the end of my sort of tenure. Like my predecessors, I was very happy to kind of pass it on at that stage, but I felt I had made a contribution, if you like.
And what do you see as the strengths of educational research in Ireland?
By a long shot, it as the technology now tells us, the report that Jim Gleeson and I and Ruth Leach in Queen's did on, you know, research and initial teacher education, that gets more downloads, continues to, than anything else that I've ever put my hand to, which is in itself interesting. I published a paper in Irish Educational Studies, I don't know, maybe about 1994 or thereabouts, that reviewed the previous 10 years of papers in IES and where they came from and whatnot. And in fact, a PhD student of mine has only very recently completed the next 10 or more years as well. The pattern hasn't changed. For the most part, the research is small scale, lack of funding is a major issue. That's not to say the small scale research doesn't serve a purpose, both for the researcher, but also the participants and so on. So I wouldn't want to undermine what goes on. But there's a bigger structural issue, and I mentioned Salberg earlier. And Salberg was very clear that the whole notion of creating critical mass in research and so on was necessary and needed to be developed, and arguably the prescription of having the six institutes of education was seen as the vehicle that was going to deliver on that. But what has been ignored since, they did acknowledge in that report that there was an absence of a research policy and adequate funding. And that is still the case. And until such time as that is addressed, it's inevitable that we end up with small-scale stuff. Okay, IRC, Irish Research Council, has kind of kicked in, and yes, education is getting some money out of that. But there's a bigger structural issue. The two identified centres, if you like, that you could argue gets the lion's share of government resources for educational research are the Educational Research Centre in Drumcondra and, of course, ESRI. From a democratic point of view, and I'm not by any means impugning the integrity of the people who do that research, but there's an over-reliance, and we've heard a lot recently about new politics and doing things differently and no more cosy consensus and so on. I'm around long enough to know that the language of reports and stuff that emanate from centres like that, that rely to a significant extent on government funding, that often the language is tempered considerably so that there is no offence, or they, you know, put somewhat differently, we can rely on the safe pair of hands that we're not going to be hung out to dry and that there will be no surprises. That's not good for the autonomy of researchers, nor is it good for research more generally and the trust that the public have in the research that we do have.
And those reflections on educational research in Ireland by Ciarán Sugrue of University College Dublin bring this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank Gemma Tuffy from the ASTI for her help in setting up the interview. To download over 300 Inside Education podcasts, go to seandelaney.com and click on the Podcasts tab. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from good bookshops and you can ask for it in your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.